Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
Here we are at the Donalana Kitchen again. And we've got good guests to talk to today. But first, a note here from Donna.
Okay. Support for the Donalana Kitchen Show comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocer in Ames. Community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
Ah, that was one of our fine underwriters. Speaking of underwriting, we had a fine underwriting this last weekend. We just got to,
oh, good one, Lana.
Wasn't it nice?
Underwriting, underwriting.
Mm. Yeah.
She's so smooth. I can't. Woo.
I like transitions.
Yeah.
So everyone can acknowledge that we had a wonderful, wonderful snowfall. It was beautiful. But now it's cold, and it's a little challenging getting around. Since I live in the country, I had the great opportunity of not only being snowed in, which is always fun, but we had a power outage for a while, so just by the time we figured out how to get out the Aladdin lantern and figured out how to, where the matches were and figured out how to get that going, then the power came back on. But we're ready now. We are ready. Because we didn't have any power and because I just plain forgot about it, I missed the Super Bowl.
Oh, gee.
Well, anyway, I heard somebody won. People had a wonderful time. People get together to celebrate the darndest things, and I know there's food is also part of the Super Bowl. Everybody likes to snack and drink beverages to their heart's content. But there are other reasons to gather. I had note of another gathering this past weekend. It was a gathering of guys. They got together, made homemade pizza, and I was invited to go, but this is a guy thing. So instead of a Super Bowl party, well, actually it was the day after the Super Bowl party, they had a chainsaw sharpening party. Yes, they did.
Yeah, that sounds really pragmatic.
It was. It got something done, and I'm sure that there were stories told and boasts made and good pizza eaten. And
we should have a knife sharpening party.
Oh,
that's what I need.
Oh, yeah, I know. See, some people know how to do these things. So, do you have anything to say about life in general, Donna?
Oh, I'm going to start off with my tirade today by way of introducing our guests. I was reading another headline again this week somewhere in the food press about how buying local is the new organic and da-da-da-da-da, and I'm going, oh, not this again. I remember when there was I think it was a Time magazine or maybe Newsweek cover. Boy, I'm going back 8 to 10 years, and it was buy local, forget organic. And I'm going, okay, this is, as we would say, an apples and oranges issue. Organic agriculture and the organic certification is about a production, an agricultural production methodology. It includes, you know, limiting the kinds of insecticides and fungicides and pesticides. It includes cultivating the soil in a certain way that you're not just putting NKP on. Did I say that right? NKP, NPK? Nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. Okay. Anyway, it is a way of growing things. Okay, so it is a production methodology. Local has to do with distribution. Where did it come from? So they are not the same at all. It is not an either or. It is a both and. You can, in the best of all worlds, you can have locally grown, organically produced foods. You can also have locally grown, heavily pesticide laden, and terrible soil quality foods. You can also have organic foods that come from halfway around the world. And in the worst case scenario, which is mostly what we see, you can have food from all over the universe grown with rather unpleasant and sometimes disturbing agricultural practices. So, guys, it's not organic or local. They are two separate things. So don't be fooled. They all are things that come on food labels, however. That's the only thing they have in common. So with us today, we have some proponents of local agriculture.
Yes, we want to welcome some good folks from Ames High School. Mike Todd is a teacher there, and students Max Ennis and Anya Chamberlain. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
You guys are going to tell us about really, truly local agriculture. What are you growing in the high school? Mike, you want to start out with just a description of Mike is a biology and environmental science teacher.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how it started. And then, you know, we started out with one plot, I guess, at the high school, and a local woman helped us get it started suitably.
And what were you growing?
Well, a variety of things then. Tomatoes, you know, just whatever the kids wanted to grow, really. I mean, carrots and, you know, the normal kinds of things. It was less crazy, yeah, than peppers and things
grow in the summer.
Yes.
So how do you deal with this?
Well, and that was part of the scary thing for the administration at first was who is going to take care of this thing over the summer and what is going to happen. And at the time, I was focused heavily on prairie, you know, restoration and native plants, and that was a big part of the environmental science course. And so we were also like, oh, I don't know about this food thing. So Sue basically took the lead with this group of students, you know, really did well with them and got it set up. And then the next year we started, you know, incorporating it into our classes more. And I was like, okay, this is it now. Now I get it. So, you know, we do it sort of in addition to the native plants.
So when they come back to school in the fall – obviously, that's harvest time in the garden.
Yes, and actually the summer too. So the students actually took it upon themselves. We have such sort of passionate students to get involved with this that they schedule themselves all summer long to come in. I mean, they're there several, three, four times a week, weeding, watering, harvesting, doing whatever they need to do, delivering stuff to the food pantries.
For no credit, probably.
Oh, no credit at all. No credit at all. I mean, there's very little recognition for this kind of thing for the kids. I mean, they don't get, like, letter jackets or, you know, T-shirts. They have to buy them if they want to. But, you know, there's no
Max is wearing a T-shirt that says Ames High Garden Club. It's actually a very cool T-shirt. Yeah. So maybe you get some, like, peer credits for it. Is it cool?
Yeah, garden club is pretty cool. A lot of people talk about, like, ask, and they're interested even if they aren't participating. And a lot of the rewards is not that you don't get satisfaction from, like, the peers being interested, but you just get satisfaction from growing something that's going to go back to the community. And that's what I really like about – that's what incentivizes garden club for me.
And I think also when I was a freshman, I didn't understand as much the value, but I became involved because my friend was actually starting the garden when she was in Mr. Todd's environmental science class. It's hard to think back to when I wasn't totally invested in it, but I think especially juniors and seniors start to think about it more because when you first come into high school, you assume that to be cool. Oh, I need to be involved with sports and, you know, kind of stereotypical high school things. But then they realize how excited students are at the garden and how you really – it's also a bonding experience. And then you mm-hmm. learn so many useful things. And it's – I found it very rewarding getting to know, like, juniors and sophomores now that I get to know as a senior. It's really nice.
So Mr. Todd, Teacher Todd, would you say that this is really student-driven then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Especially
– amazing.
Yeah, no, it's totally student-driven. Things don't happen without them. So I think that's one, a certain philosophy of running something is how much ownership do the students have. It needs to be, like, a lot of them. I mean, it has to be a majority of them. It has to be them doing the things. It has to be them, you know – coming up with ideas and the goals and those sorts of things and running.
Certainly
it
because, the manpower. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So
labor, free labor.
Yeah, so, and I think it's ideal. I mean, it's just much more educational experience and it becomes theirs and people buy into it. It's not like, you know, no matter what, we're going to have it all planned out for you guys. It's not that kind of thing. So it's much more educational if it's not. You know, I mean, they're learning so much, contacting people, figuring out how to do things, realizing that we try things and about 50% of it does not work. You know, that's life. That's normal. That's okay, guys.
Yeah, that's hard. Gardening is hard. Yeah.
There's a lot of failure involved. And I think during the regular school curriculum, we don't get that. Like, there's not – we aren't supposed to fail our classes. Like, that's not something that's intended. But in the garden, there's nothing, like, holding you back from failing. So we do it all the time. And
a preparation for life.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Good.
Exactly.
We like to have an opportunity to fail for students. I mean, that's – in all – in our – and the way we structure a lot of our classes now is you need – they need that opportunity to fail. And it's a learning experience. It's part of life. It's overcoming things. It's not failure unless you fail to learn something from it. So – you know, that's it. And so now we're growing. I don't know how many different kinds of things we grew this year, 40, 50 different kinds of crazy things, and half of them didn't work.
I mean, that was one thing that we actually learned through all the failure, I guess, and successes. We learned what works, what doesn't. But we had so many things last year. It was hard to keep track of them, and we didn't get – our tomatoes got completely root-bound. They were in the containers for too long that the seedlings we'd started – so we had way too many tomatoes. So now we know, okay, do fewer, but make sure we get them planted on time. And then, so there are a lot more things that I'm trying to be on top of and have planned out ahead of time. So it's not hectic, you know, when the last frost date comes, we'll be ready.
Yeah. There's a lot of things, a lot of balls you have to juggle, keep up in the air to remember you're dealing with a living thing, and it's not going to stand still for you at all.
Yeah,
I'm interested, too, in the high school providing a space for this sort of thing. Usually, students come to a class. They sit down. There's a classroom. There's desks. There's probably all sorts of computer equipment. There's boards up front. But when it comes to gardening, what did you start with? I'm sure you didn't come across – they didn't provide you with a ready-made, tilled-up organic garden ready to go. Where did – tell about the first garden. Where did it go, and what's it turned into?
Well, Mr. Todd can probably elaborate more on the very, very beginning. But when I was involved, it consisted of
– Anya's a senior now.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a senior now, but when I was a freshman, there were some juniors and seniors working on it. And so they were the ones, and there are some people in their environmental science class, they were the ones that started digging it up and had, I don't know if they had kind of a temporary fence there.
Yeah, it was more like bird netting, I think, was the...
bird netting is important sometimes.
Bird netting and T-posts were basically what our fence consisted of in the beginning.
And you started with sod. You started with grass.
And some of the most compact sod, probably, at the high school, because we had a... That it was like the year before that we had a gas leak right before school started and the road couldn't get finished, so the kids had to, or the staff had to drive over this piece of land to get to the back parking lot. That was the site that was chosen. So you know, cars drove over top of this dirt for like, you know, weeks.
It sounds like humble beginnings and a lot of hard work. so there were picks and shovels involved?
No, just kids.
Just kids.
Just with their fingernails.
No, oh, no.
I'm pretty sure we had shovels. I'm pretty sure. I might have given them a shovel or two.
Oh, good.
And how did you finance this project?
Sue DeBleek in Urban Dreams raised money from the community. So we still have that original list of people, many people that, you know, you probably know, who she went and got things, raised money. And I think it raised like $500-$600, you know, to buy all these supplies and a couple of tools and things like that. And that was kind of the beginning. And our principal in the very beginning, he was very new to the – Mr. Evans was brand new. And he was kind of like, what's going on here, Mike? I'll trust you. We'll see how it goes. You know, and I wasn't even sure in the beginning. But then I'm really glad she put in that initial effort to make it happen, because we have taken that and totally expanded it. It would have never happened without that initial plot of land. And now Mr. Evans funds – everything that the garden club needs, he will.
So it's kind of part of the science department then, basically?
Well, yeah, we don't do department budgeting, but it's an extracurricular sort of activity that he funds and tries to, you know, support in any way he can. So, and when we expanded from that first plot into an edibles garden in our courtyard that the kids eat lunch in when it's warm.
They eat lunch in the garden?
They eat lunch in a courtyard. A lot of kids, hundreds of kids probably, you think, eat lunch out there.
Yeah.
We decided one year, the next year, maybe the year after, to plant a little garden plot in that in that courtyard, and we called it the edibles garden. So we were going to plant things that kids could go over and kind of eat and snack on during lunch. And that was kind of an interesting plot because also that place had been waterlogged with – it had always been – the gutter didn't work there. So that was constantly flooded with water, and so we had to fix all these issues. And but, you know, we got students involved in different projects, and they started rainwater harvesting, and they started a compost pile out there, and they started, you know, a variety
fantastic.
Of things. And so then students developed signage for this to explain these concepts to the students who were there. And this year they're putting in a strip of native plants in front of that garden as a sort of a benefit to the garden and the ecosystem. So there's constantly students involved all the time in changing these spaces and making them different, and it's been really beneficial.
And did they eat from the garden?
Yeah, when there's stuff to eat, a lot of times garden club members are the only ones to eat from the garden. But we always encourage people to just go in and take what they want. But this year we had a lot of cucumbers in the garden, and so that's not always the most appetizing thing for someone.
Love
on. Yeah, like I personally love cucumbers. But
we had a lot of overgrown cucumbers, so they're kind of sour.
Yeah, they were very. I had
that's
a cucumber a day for about a month. In the
one
month
of those
of
learning experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, also those overgrown cucumbers, they could always turn into art projects. Always turn into sculpture. So yes, because there's a lot of people in a high school. You've got a lot of good minds working on how
that's
to
good
use
idea.
Things.
Good idea.
Good. And so this is good news. You don't have to start from scratch every year. You have a garden that gets better every year as you mm-hmm. use it, and you're expanding into different areas around the school. This is wonderful.
And did you say you have hoop houses now?
Mm-hmm. We have.
Yeah, when did that start?
Well, last year we used some like little low tunnels. I think we used those at the beginning of the season a little bit. And then during the fall this past year, a lot of members helped build a movable greenhouse. So we have the greenhouse with low tunnels inside. And right now we have some lettuce and pak choy.
Wow. Carrots and,
carrots.
Spinach.
Well, it's not growing very rapidly, but it is still alive.
Well, if it's not dead, that's good, right?
How big are these houses? Or how big are the hoop houses?
The movable greenhouse is about 10 feet wide and about 20 feet long.
Oh, great.
That's pretty
right?
Serious.
Yeah. So it's a large structure, mm-hmm. But it doesn't contain – like we've got some pretty big plots, but it's nice just to have the vegetables there over the winter. So we have something to do, a little bit of lettuce to eat because we started that pretty early. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it grows nicely.
You construct the hoop houses yourself?
Yeah, yeah.
Was it a kit, Max? Just like A, B, put this bolt in here. Was that –
what is this, amateur hour? No, we built the movable greenhouse from scratch. Last spring, they bought a lot of metal poles, screws, started bending those. Who is the – Elliot Coleman? Yeah.
It's his style.
Yeah,
oh,
it's his longhouses. And so we used his style of – construction. We followed his directions, bent the poles ourselves. This fall we realized, we haven't been working on this all summer. Let's get going. It took quite a while. Mm-hmm. It was a hard project.
A lot of lunch periods that we worked together.
A lot of lunch periods, a lot of two-hour sessions after school. But we were able to get it done just in time for the weather to start getting cold. And so it was a satisfying experience, definitely. Mm-hmm.
And how are the hoop houses dealing with the snow load and the wind and Iowa winters? Is it working out okay?
Yeah, I went out there, checked on them yesterday, and it holds up just fine. Elliot Coleman's got some good engineering going on. And
yeah, he changed it from a total just circular hoop to a Gothic arch. And recently, and so we to handle the snow load in Maine, so we made the Gothic arch one, so they have a peak, so it actually doesn't – the snow load doesn't actually do much with it. But the wind even – they screwed in anchors. Tell them about the screwing in of the anchor to hold this thing down in the strongest winds.
Well, we had about like 3-foot-long anchors, so we don't get a greenhouse coming through a school window one day. but – our garden is not very rocky, but in one corner we started running into a rock, and it was just like the most frustrating thing because we had the greenhouse like over the fence, like the plastic – or no, the plastic wasn't on, but like this like big metal frame is up, and we just couldn't get the anchor and we couldn't move forward. And so we spent like a day on that just trying to figure out where to put the anchor.
Dynamite or something?
I think we used dynamite in the end. It was the easiest.
at least.
Yeah. It's an old farmer trick. Get out the dynamite.
Oh, that's wonderful. I've had hoop houses and things give way to the snow, and I've had successes too. That the Gothic arch is a wonderful idea.
Well, and just in case our listeners don't know, Elliot Coleman is sort of he's a Maine gardener,
Maine
state of Maine, right? And he kind of pioneered this whole thing of growing in the winter in colder climates, and the movable hoop house. Explain what's movable about it and how it works. This is an Elliot Coleman consideration. Very brilliant.
Well, it's movable in the sense that it's fairly light. We were able to lift it up with about 7 people, lift it over a fence, which is 4 feet, 3 feet and a half high.
Are we moving the
Well, because we constructed it outside the garden, and so we wanted it to be in the garden because that's where we grow the plants.
And each season, we can also put it in a different location in the garden, especially if you're doing something that's a really, like, heavy feeder, I guess, from the soil. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to grow broccoli the same place every year, you know.
So you can rotate your fields.
Yeah, depending on
where. Fields, your garden plots.
Yeah. And then even within the same season, we didn't really have it established in a super efficient system yet this year. But if there's something... you know, that can tolerate just a light amount of frost. We can leave it in one part, like the tomatoes, maybe have it over the tomatoes during, like, light fall months, mm-hmm. and then later move it over something else we wouldn't have throughout the winter. So,
How late did you have tomatoes, if you kind of coaxed them along?
Well, we didn't have very great success with the tomatoes. Mm-hmm. We didn't use the hoop house over them. I think we're still constructing it. Mm-hmm. But... we'll see how far that goes this year. I don't know. We'll probably have, like, a couple different batches of, I don't know.
Are you going to use the hoop house to start things early? Because we're into mm-hmm. seed planting for the spring already. So what are you going to do for the spring?
Well, yeah, using the hoop house, like, we had a winter crop that, like, we planted pretty late in November, I would say. And so it's been growing very slowly, so that might still be around in the springtime, so we can have a very early spring harvest. Or, like, if that fails to the cold temperatures, because January, February, usually pretty bitter, if that fails, we can replant something in there in March, and it'll be ready in July.
I'm planning on putting a bunch of, like, lettuce and spinach seeds just...
anybody doing some endives?
I guess so.
Or radicchios?
We should look into it.
I think we planted some in the greenhouse this year. So I think some other people have.
They can be hardy and they're green. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. we don't get very much of that around here. Personally, yeah. I'll put an order in. What do you do with your food, by the way?
That's something that's actually changing. It's going to be kind of more invigorated this year, I guess. Because the foods teacher at the high school, Miss Van Wardhuizen.
Would that be what we used to call home ec?
Yes.
The foods teacher.
Yeah. Hmm. They kind of separated up into different categories now. But so for the foods, yeah, she's really excited about using the stuff from the garden in classes, and also letting kids come and use the kitchen after school from the garden club, something that we didn't really have the ability to do before. And trying to cook it, like, in the biology classroom was a problem. Like, get an induction burner or something and grow it next to Mr. Todd's gross decomposition projects. I don't know.
But again, it sounds like a learning experience. That's mm-hmm. good.
Yep.
I wanted to remind everyone that we're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to students and a teacher from Ames High, And we're learning about growing food on a high school grounds. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to Mike Todd, Max Ennis, and Anya Chamberlain about growing food at the Ames High School. So I want to ask you about what your plans are for spring, and do you have a place to grow seedlings?
Yeah, we do. Not only do we have the movable greenhouse, which we were talking about before the break, we have an indoor greenhouse, indoor greenhouse. It's connected to the school.
That was an existing structure in the school.
Yeah, it would have been used for biology experiments,
How big is it?
There's three components.
Or like three big room sections, I guess.
Just like standard greenhouse size, but like it's like cut
100 and some feet long, probably by, you know, 30-40 feet
wide. That's not a small space.
You can right, and that's not that's a usual amazing. Component in a high school. So
no, they built it in 1984 from like scratch, and these science teachers got together and thought it was this excellent tool, and it has been an amazing tool for doing all kinds of things throughout the year. We grow native plants in it for projects that we do in the spring, and we go out and, you know, unload all these native plants in our community in all different kinds of ways. And then when the garden club came around, we had a place to start seedlings. So,
oh, that's wonderful. So tell me about techniques for starting seedlings. And what are some of the first things you're going to start? I'm getting kind of itchy myself. This is what we can put in the ground. So tell me about starting seedlings in your greenhouse.
Well, this year we ordered from Johnny's. They've got like a soil block creator. So you can just drop seeds in there and they'll grow. It doesn't compact the roots too much and it's easy to transplant. We're actually starting onions, shallots, and leeks tonight. We're having our first big meeting of the year and we're going to get all the new members out into the greenhouse planting. It'll be the first thing we plant this year.
Good. Talk more about the soil block thing. I've done that in the past. It's kind of like playing in a sandbox. You kind of pack things into this form maker, and you make these little blocks out of dirt, which are really nice to grow the seeds in. How many do you make? I mean,
well, you know more about it than we do. This is our experiment this year, so we always try to learn something new, add something piece to it, and so our goal is to start these soil blocks and mm-hmm. use them. We had done some newspaper pots last year. Mm-hmm. We had some soil pot makers, and we've tried a variety of plastic containers. And we were trying to get – by going to the paper last year with the paper pots, we were trying to get away from plastic and away from as much of that. And so mm-hmm. we'll see. It's our next venture into
good.
The unknown.
Good luck with that. I've always had good luck with soil blocks. I don't use them too much because – you do need room, but it sounds like you've got a plenty good greenhouse. Also, you've got lots of willing hands to move things around. You'll have a good time with those. So, yeah, as I understand it, and in my experience in the past, is that seeds planted in a soil block have plenty of air movement and less chance of getting root-bound and overly waterlogged because the air is going all around that little block. It's like planting into a dirt ice cube sort of thing. And good luck with that.
It said that specifically that air prunes the roots on the edges, so there's mm-hmm. never this kind of growing around in a spiral. And mm-hmm. then when you put them in the ground, you have this sort of transplant shock, and it just is mm-hmm. – it sort of is stunted for quite a while in its growth. And so they said these soil blocks, because it's all air pruned around the edges, that – once you get it in the ground, it just kind of takes off into the ground.
Tell me what air pruning is exactly.
Well, my understanding is the roots can't grow into the air. So mm-hmm. so then they die back and they just kind of stay close to those edges then. Mm-hmm. And then when you put them in the ground, they're ready to run right into the soil. So it's something, I don't know. And these blocks are about an inch and a half by an inch and a half square. And then I'm not sure, a couple inches.
I'm going to have to learn this, Lana, because – starting seedlings is my downfall. I'm not delicate enough, I believe. But.
Yeah, and what we're hoping to do with the soil blocks is not all of the garden club members are lifetime gardeners. They don't know a lot of the finer aspects of starting seedlings, and if soil blocks can make starting seedlings a lot easier, that's a really big benefit. It's a benefit to anyone, but especially to a group of inexperienced and learning gardeners.
Less possibilities for failure.
Well, yeah, that's a downside to it. But
so, what are you planting in these little blocks? Okay, tonight you're doing all of the
alliums.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oniony things.
Mm-hmm. We've got a lot. We ordered about. Just like as a preliminary order, about 40 different varieties of plants or seeds from Johnny's and Seed Savers, primarily Seed Savers. But we've got basic stuff like tomatoes, but then with the tomatoes we're looking at stuff that has a lot of nutrients.
Purple
and black tomatoes. We're just experimenting with a lot of different newer varieties.
The Seed Saver guy once told me, because I had this big complaint. I'd lived in California when, of course, heirloom tomatoes became a big deal. And, of course, the varieties that grow really well there became kind of the darlings, like the Cherokee Purple and the this and that. And so when I moved back to Iowa, people were growing the same varieties that they were growing in California. However, our climate is so different that the taste of the same tomatoes that we were getting here was not what I was used to in California. So I was a little disappointed. So I was discussing this with, I can't remember their main gardener guy. They had a year where they had a big tomato extravaganza. They do it every year, though. But so he said in Iowa, because they grow a lot in Iowa, we're really lucky to have them here, that the Russian varieties are particularly flavorful here because those old heirlooms are more suited to the kind of climate that we have here. Do you guys grow a lot of different varieties and do taste tests and see what does well and what tastes good to you and things like that?
We try to get a large variety. So with our garlic last year, we had a German variety. I think we had Russian something. I can't remember exactly, but we always
multiple
try
varieties.
To have, yeah, uh-huh. at least a couple. And so, like, with carrots, we have some different kinds of purple ones, different orange ones. And then I think, one of my goals, at least, is really to help educate other high schoolers about just vegetable varieties and mm-hmm, stuff so mm-hmm. things don't seem I guess, scary or foreign. I don't know. Because some people are there.
Anya's into cooking. She's yeah. So.
Some people are there not necessarily just because they, like, love vegetables, but just because they think it sounds fun. But then I hope... I'm always pretty excited about the things that we can cook with them. And then, you know, having, like, lacinato kale versus red Russian kale, like, what they're good for and trying to just, I don't know.
How do you first speak to someone who asks you the question, well, why would you want to grow your vegetables? You can just go to the store and get them. What's the difference? I mean, why bother?
So for me, there are a lot of different levels or layers to that. Why I value growing vegetables.
Yeah.
So obviously there are all the things having to do with like sustainability and the energy it takes to transport and lots of times like the pesticides used on ones that you get the grocery store. But I also like kind of in like Alice Water vein, I guess she. She really encourages. There's a school where she's helping grow a garden where students cook
this
their food
in
for
Berkeley,
lunch.
In Berkeley, California, yeah.
Yeah.
The Shea Pennies Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm really inspired by those kinds of things, having a, you know, like personal connection to our food, because through grocery stores, people, maybe lots of high schoolers go and, like, okay, your parents get the groceries. They don't think about where it came from. And to me, there's kind of a emotional satisfaction in seeing it, you know, like a little seedling. It's so tiny. And then a couple months later, after effort, you have something beautiful that you can cook and then share with friends. And it's there's so many aspects of it to be enjoyed.
Oh, yes. You're, after all, dealing with life. You're dealing with the tiny seed up into a plant. And what can be more dynamic than working with that? That mm-hmm. sounds absolutely wonderful. Tell me about some of the resources. You mentioned permaculture classes that you've and permaculture things that are going on at your high school. Tell us about that.
So last year, myself and about six other students and Mr. Todd and another science teacher went to the Practical Farmers of Iowa conference where we attended a short course about permaculture. It was 10 hours, so across 2 days, it felt pretty long. But we learned a
big
lot
topic.
About... Yep. Yeah, no, there was definitely... The time was filled with a lot of valuable information. So we've used that as kind of a foundation for some permaculture areas that students started around the high school, and understanding the different layers of plants can be grown together with trees and then smaller shrubs and then underground varieties.
You want to make this into a... Give a quick definition of permaculture.
Permaculture.
Oh, okay. That's very hard. To a lot of people, I think it means there are, you know, different definitions you'd come up with. But basically, what Mark Shepherds was telling us, he's from Wisconsin, basically... utilizing all of the sunlight that's in one area by using many, many varieties of mostly perennials to grow at different heights and levels, you know, so have really tall shrub or really tall trees with smaller trees around that, and then shrubs, and then little bushes, and then smaller plants like herbs and things that are ground cover. And so it really, they also... help each other in symbiotic ways, and then also having animals in the equation, which is something, unfortunately, that we haven't been able to have happen at Ames High. It's kind of a long-term goal or dream of ours. So we're trying to establish these areas where the plants can utilize all of the little niches, right?
Yeah, Anya, maybe mm-hmm. when you go off to college, you can pick a college that has animals on the farm.
Yeah, that'd be fine with me.
There are lots of schools, colleges doing that too. Mm-hmm. So,
yes, permaculture, permanent agriculture, I think, mm-hmm. sort of.
Yeah,
it's a good idea. It's a good idea.
And so, do you ever grow so much that you have excesses of things?
Yeah, that's. It's not necessarily an excess.
That would be a success.
Yeah, it's a success in terms of growing it, but a lot of times, like last year, we ran into problems of not being able to distribute all of it in time before, like, the tomatoes went bad. Because we don't sell any of it. We try and give it all away. And we just didn't have enough outlets to give it away to keep up with our production, which was, like, it was a good year, and we just couldn't keep up with that. So that's a lot of what we're working on.
Have you fixed that so that should you have a successful harvest this year, what will happen to it?
I think my hope for that is just sometimes I think high schoolers can be timid about taking something, but I just try to tell them, no, take this. Try and make zucchini bread or something.
Free food. What a concept.
Yeah. So maybe some students feel intimidated, but I really want students to be able to cook them. And then so we're planning to have more days when students can go to the foods classroom and cook things in there because the teacher is really excited about, you know, like the Alice Waters kind of stuff I was talking about. So that's personally my hope.
So you think that that having the involvement of the foods teacher will mitigate this problem?
Well, another thing we've been looking at, Ames School District has a homeless liaison that covers the entire district, but she works with a lot of homeless and at-risk students. And so we've thought about working with that department of the school in order to distribute like fresh foods to children who don't necessarily have access to it because
throughout the whole school system.
Yeah, throughout Ames High and throughout the entire school system. And so because we cook a lot of food, but we can't cook all the kale we have. We can't use all the tomatoes we have. And so we need more. I actually went to a short course at PFI with Todd Randall, and he has a very diverse farm in terms of the stuff he grows and where he sells it at. And I think that's what I really took from his talk was, like, you need to have multiple outlets to distribute your product. Even though we're not selling it, we still need the backup just in case, like, not a lot of people want to cook one year or, like, there's not as much demand for fresh food from food pantries and the homeless liaison. Mm-hmm. So we just want to have those systems in place.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot to learn when you start a garden in high school.
Mm-hmm.
You're learning not only how to start from a seed and go on from there, but there's all sorts of things that are connected.
Yes, there's the sociology of the situation. This is wonderful that you're getting all this at a high school level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. Like me and Anya, who have taken, or Anya and I should say, I'm on the radio. Anya and I have, like, we've taken more of a leadership position, and so we discussed a lot of that, like how, like, what approach do we take to, like, teaching people how to grow and teaching people where to grow and showing people what to do, because, like, a lot of the club needs direction. Like, do we do that by, like, inspiring people to work on an individual level, or do you do that, like, to inspire the group to work as a group in a really communal way? And so it's stuff we're still figuring out. It's stuff that we don't know. Like, we're starting to get a clue, but it might take a couple more generations of leaders in the club to figure out what really works for a really efficient garden.
And good, when you figure it out, you can tell us here in the rest of the society how we can work together,
how we can feed each other. A really good skill set to start at your age. Fantastic.
Yes. Let's listen to a little tune called Maddie's Garden. You're listening to KHOI, Community Radio for the Heart of Iowa. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. I've been in the kitchen lately since it's been snowy and cold outside.
So I am munching on the fruits of that.
So I made some cookies. These cookies were inspired by a show we did a couple weeks ago. We talked to our friend Bashak, who talked to us about
Turkish food.
Turkish food, but the Middle East has got all kinds of different foods. And with understanding around the world being rather slim these days, I think a good way to understand people halfway across the world is to look up a recipe and make
something. Learn
about their culture.
The good parts are that we always eat, and no matter what culture you're from, there are some delicious things there. That is human nature, and we all have it. We all share it. These are really good Iranian cookies.
Right. This is a recipe from Iran, and it's a rice flour cookie recipe. I've made this recipe a couple of times. I originally started making the cookies because I was looking for things that didn't have wheat in them, and I usually make them for Christmas a lot, but they're good any old time. They're sort of like a shortbread, lots of butter, eggs.
Where do you get the rice flour, Lana?
Rice flour from Food Co-op rice flour. So one note about this recipe from Iran, this rice flour recipe. It's got lots of egg yolks, no egg whites, lots of egg yolks, lots of butter, confectioner's sugar, rice flour. And it's flavored with rose water and cardamom. Really good things, really good things. And I've got a note on this recipe. This will eventually end up on our website, so you can find it there. Go to the khoifm.org page and find our webpage there. And it'll be there eventually, called Rice Flour Cookies from Iran. My note is that this recipe takes time. Read the whole recipe first, because the rice flour needs a little bit of a fuss. First, you take 2.5 cups rice flour and you spread it on a warm tray and put it in a warm oven for about an hour. I don't know why, but the recipe said the flour has to be very dry for this. So we can do that. All right. So that takes an hour. And then you beat the eggs, sugar, rose water, butter until creamy. Add the flour, add the cardamom. And now, because this is not like wheat flour, you stir it for a while, but then you end up kneading this dough for a while on a floured.
Is that because the rice doesn't absorb as quickly the way the wheat flour does? So
right.
It just takes a while to soak up.
Right. It feels completely different.
Down.
So here you are with this very yellowy sort of dough, and you knead it for a while. And then you let it sit on the counter covered with a damp towel for 6 hours.
Interesting.
It really does make a difference.
Right. The absorptive quality of the rice is very different from the wheat that we're used to for baking.
Right. So you end up with this little bit of kneaded dough. After 6 hours, you bake in a 325 degree oven. You roll out little small bits of dough, put them on a cookie sheet, press them with a fork tine to flatten slightly, like you're making other kinds.
They're very cute.
Yeah. And then you can garnish with poppy seeds if you'd like. And you have to be careful.
About the size of $0.50.
Yeah, right. Good with tea. Excellent with tea. Don't overbake these cookies. And I really like these. These are rice flours.
Very delicate.
From Iran. Mm-hmm. And they're flavored with rose water and flavored with cardamom. And they keep really well, too. Although they won't keep well because you'll eat them, of course. So that's it. Oh, Donna, this is Tuesday. Let folks know what's going on this evening.
Oh, I have a mouthful of cookie.
All right.
at Wheatsfield, we're doing a stone soup cooking class where basically we're just talking about how you can kind of throw together your own soups and stews and all those things that we like for cold weather. And I'll be focusing on stock, which is the basis of it. So we're going to have a chicken stock, a beef stock, a dashi, which is the Japanese version of a vegetarian seaweed stock, basically, that you then put miso soup in. And also, I have a really funny recipe for a tomato stock. So we'll be doing that tonight. Both Lana and I will be at Wheatsfield. It's at 7. I think it's already filled, and you do need a reservation, but...
call ahead, because they do they do let people in if you're really nice to them. I've done that in the past.
And they'll be tasting.
Yes.
It's more fun than the radio, because you can actually smell it and see it and feel it and taste it.
Oh, good. Oh, good. So, look forward to that upcoming class this evening. And I have a little bit of food trivia here. I found this off the internet, actually in a magazine that's made from the internet. They have an internet site, too. This is something about Julia Child and food. Of course, Julia Child is connected with food, that fine, fine chef. However, this little bit of trivia says Julia Child's first recipe wasn't for creme brulee or crepes. It had nothing to do with food. Her first recipe was for scaring sharks. During World War II, the Navy had an issue with curious sharks bumping into mines and torpedoes and accidentally setting them off, not to mention all the problems it caused for the sailors. So, Julia Child was working at the Office of Strategic Services, our fine government, and was tasked with making a concoction to keep away the big fish. Her solution was a mix of black dye, copper acetate, and water-soluble wax. And it was used by the War Department for 3 decades. So, there you go.
Why, do you suppose they didn't like the smell?
I don't know.
Must have been a repellent.
It must have worked. So, good for you, Julia Child, keeping us free from sharks.
Exploding sharks.
Exploding sharks. That's good. We've been talking with people from the Ames High School today. We've been learning about spring. We've been learning about things that are growing there, and everybody's thoughts are turning to spring now. So we'll be, in our future shows, we'll be talking about seed catalogs and what's going on in your garden and what do you have plans for. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with Lana Noctegal.
And Donna Prisgintas.
With excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Special guests, Mike Todd, Max Ennis, and Anya Chamberlain. Listen to the Donna Lana Kitchen Tuesday at noon and 7 o'clock in the evening. Dream and look forward to spring. Plant a seed. It's a revolutionary act. You've been listening to music by Dulcimer player Sam Rosetta. Eat good food and enjoy life.
Yum.